Quite simply, the panel on campaign finance is what the effects of campaign finance are, what we're all experiencing right now, especially if you live in the DC area, since Virginia is a battleground state. And that is, on the contribution side, campaign finance deals with who can contribute what, in what amount, to whom, and for what purpose. And on the expenditure side, of course, campaign finance governs who can spend what amount of money for what purpose related to election. And we've really seen, I think, over the past two election cycles, not because of the elections themselves, but because of changes in the law and in the governing legal precedent from the Supreme Court, a sea change in campaign finance law. If you go back to the election of 2000, we were, of course, operating before McCain-Feingold or the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act under the old Gore-Buckley regime, where basically we were operating under the magic words test for broadcast advertising, for any advertising related to elections, whether it was express advocacy, which could be pulled into regulation, or whether it was issue advocacy and didn't use the magic words urging the election or defeat of candidate. Then, of course, between the elections of 2000 and 2004, McCain-Feingold passed and was signed into law by George Bush and was immediately met with a challenge, McConnell versus Federal Election Commission, that ended up in the Supreme Court that they decided in 2003. That changed the face of what broadcast advertisements were permissibly regulated by the Federal Election Commission, because part of McCain-Feingold created a category called electioneering communications that were prescribed, meaning that there were certain prescriptions as to who could pay for such advertisements and whether they fell into regulations 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election. And then, thanks to one of our panelists, that category changed again, because in Wisconsin Right to Life, the Supreme Court made it clear that the electioneering communications provision could not, if there was constitutional protection for grassroots lobbying ads. And then also, in the same time period after the 2004 elections, the Federal Election Commission dealt with the advertising and the spending that had been done by 527 organizations like SWIFT, the Veterans for Truth, America Coming Together, Progress for America. And that area of law and campaign finance is still in flux. But I think, at least from my perspective, I think that we are seeing less advertising in this election cycle from 527s than we saw in the 2004 election cycle. And I think that that will certainly be probably one of the topics that our panel will discuss this morning. As I said, I think we're privileged to have four of the leading lights of the campaign finance bar, including two former members of the Federal Election Commission, one person who is probably on the attorney signature line for virtually any suit you can name that is challenging something the Federal Election Commission is doing, and another person who was formerly chief counsel to the Democratic National Committee. And so let me introduce our panelists in the order that they're going to give their opening statements. First, to my immediate right, is James Bach. James Bach has a national election law practice and is probably best known for successfully arguing multiple cases in this area before the United States Supreme Court. Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, Wisconsin Right to Life versus Federal Election Commission that actually came up in two iterations, and also Randall versus Sorrell, who is also one of the lead counsels in McConnell versus FEC. He currently serves as a general counsel for the James Madison Center for Free Speech and as a general counsel for the National Right to Life Committee. He, at one point, was the general counsel for the Indiana Republican Party, and he's also the vice chairman, I think, of the Republican National Committee. To his right, speaking second, is Joseph Birkenstock. Joseph Birkenstock, as I mentioned, is formerly chief counsel of the Democratic National Committee and is currently a partner practicing in the political law area at Kaplan and Drysdale. He was in the Democratic National Committee at a time that was, I think, particularly significant in their election law experience, as he was there during the Florida recount in the 2000 election between Bush versus Gore. And he also had the responsibility of handling moving the Democratic National Committee into this post-McCain-Feingold world. He was also recently listed in Washingtonian Magazine as one of D.C.'s best lawyers. Bradley Smith, to Mr. Birkenstock's right, is a professor of law at Capital University and also a former member and chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Mr. Smith has been described as the most sought-after witness in the national discussion on campaign finance and is the author of the book Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform, which George Will praised as the year's most important book on governance in 2001. He is also of counsel to the law firm in Columbus and Washington, D.C., of Lori Sayer, Seymour & Peace, and he obviously keeps a very busy campaign finance schedule commenting on these issues, both in the academic literature and in the popular literature. Finally, to Mr. Smith's right, is Scott Thomas. Scott Thomas is with Fixstein Shapiro here in Washington, D.C. He, like Mr. Smith, is a former chairman and member of the Federal Election Commission. In fact, he was a commissioner from 1996 to 2000, so he enjoyed an extremely long tenure on the commission. He's a graduate of the Georgetown University Law Center and maintains a busy practice in political law. So with that, I guess I'd like to start off the panel with Mr. Bob.
Thank you. It's really great to serve on a panel with such distinguished panelists, each of which have been on the same side with me on these issues and on the opposite side of me with these issues. And I've always respected each of them and the contributions that they have made to this discussion about campaign finance. What I want to talk about is the rise of 527s in our campaign finance system. And it all goes back to this. The Internal Revenue Service, of course, administers Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is the section that provides tax exemption to, quote, political organizations, end quote. This was adopted in the late 40s. When incumbent members of Congress were concerned that the IRS was going to tax their political campaigns because there was no specific not-for-profit provision that would apply to political organizations. So they passed this, and as a result, candidate campaigns, political parties, PACs were all tax-exempt. Now, at the same time, or subsequently, actually, we had the development of campaign finance laws that dealt with particularly who is a PAC. And a PAC, of course, is defined as someone that makes a contribution or receives a contribution of $1,000 to influence an election, or makes an expenditure of $1,000 to influence an election. And subsequently, the Supreme Court in Buckley in 76 applied the major purpose test. So you also have to have, as your major purpose, the election or nomination of a candidate. Well, these two provisions, you know, tracked each other. In other words, they were coterminous until the late 1990s. And that is because of two phenomena. One is that the IRS has been increasingly and progressively expanding what they consider to be political intervention. And while the Federal Election Commission has certainly been endeavoring to do that as far as the definition of PAC is concerned, it hasn't been successful because of the demands of the First Amendment and the litigation that has occurred surrounding those efforts of the Federal Election Commission to expand what is considered to be a PAC. So they developed a gap Issue advocacy was considered political intervention as far as the IRS was concerned, but it was not considered to be regulated activity as far as the FICA was concerned. So you had this gap. And so what you had was what I called issue advocacy 527. That is, that are political organizations under the IRS that are not PACs under federal election law. Now, the first one that was set up nationally, this issue advocacy 527, was in 2000. It was called the Republican Majority Issues Committee, and I was their lawyer. And they had spent several hundred thousand dollars in issue ads supporting Republican House members. Now, one good barometer of where people think the politics of this resides is to watch Bob Bauer. Now, he has a wonderful blog, and I really enjoy his commentary. And by and large, frankly, I agree with his commentary. But here, looking at this history, you will see, I think, where people are viewing the political advantages to exist. Of course, as you know, Bob Bauer is probably the most prominent Democrat lawyer and represents right now the Obama campaign. And, of course, in 2000, he was outraged about the idea of these issue advocacy 527s and, in fact, sued Remnick for RICO violations and failure to report to the Federal Election Commission. Ultimately, that case was unsuccessful. Well, then comes along McCain-Feingold in 2002, approved by the Supreme Court in 2003. And, of course, at that time, everyone knew and understood that as that law would limit soft money donations to political parties and restrict the advertising of established C4s and C3s, that the money was going to go somewhere else, and the most likely, or at least some of it, and the most likely vehicle for that was a 527, issue advocacy 527. Pioneered in 2000, and the Democrats were ready to get those things up and running as soon as McCain-Feingold was approved, and they did. They did a very good job of adapting to changes of the law. Well, of course, the response to that by the Republican National Committee was that either 527s were already illegal, which they claimed and filed complaints, or that at least they should be made illegal by the Federal Election Commission or by Congress. And because they viewed there to be a partisan problem here, one that they should have responded to politically and organizationally, not making their opponents illegal. Of course, at that time, early 2004, Bob Bauer thought 527s were a wonderful idea. And, of course, he was defending them tenaciously. My position on it was that these organizations were perfectly legal, and something that separated me from some of my Republican brethren, and I published an article in Roll Call in February of 2004 making that point. Now, those regulatory efforts at least failed for that election cycle, and as we know, the 527 group that probably was the most influential with the swift votes helping the Republican nominee, and it just goes to show how you know that a particular campaign finance reform is going to help you or hurt you ultimately. You know, we have a problem seeing into the future. Now, the Republican National Committee has now changed their view, a resolution broadly supported, including by the Honorable Chairman of the Rules Committee, David Norcross, is here. Which was passed in the winter of 2005, put the Republican National Committee on record as opposing any further regulatory efforts on C3, C4s, or 527s. So the RNC is now off that jihad against 527s. Now, of course, there were these complaints, though, pending 1 minute. How much is the time going to end? Huh? Okay, thank you. I'm negotiating it. Of course, there were these complaints pending, and there were also lawsuits brought by the reformers saying, "Hey, you got to, you should be issuing regulations, FEC, on how you're going to regulate these 527s. Well, ultimately, that was all resolved with no regulations, but with an enforcement policy that was announced through a series of conciliation agreements where people who are subject to these investigations and who, if sued in court, would have been liable for, if the FEC prevailed, a fine equal to their expenditures, you know, like $50 million, had given in, paid a modest fine compared with their potential liability, and the FEC then had what an enforcement policy. Well, and of course, now we have, in this election cycle, that enforcement policy being bandied about by various reformers, including threatening criminal prosecution if you would fall under this new enforcement policy of a PAC. Well, that enforcement policy is unconstitutional in every element. I mean, there is no constitutional element to the policy. It relies upon, first, the definition of express advocacy to find this expenditure that has been declared unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit, the First Circuit, and the Southern District of New York. How many agencies enforce regulations that the courts have struck down? Number two, to find this $1,000 in contributions, they say that if the organization receives money because they're going to support or oppose a candidate, whatever in the heck that is, they admit the other trigger. And then to determine the major purpose test, we're not going to look at regulable activity. No. We're going to look at everything you do to see whether or not your issue advocacy might influence an election. Each one of those are unconstitutional, already decided, unconstitutional by the Supreme Court and several other circuits. So there we have, there we have an enforcement policy that I agree has been resulted in less advertised, because no one in their right mind, at least unless you're a multi-billionaire, you know, that could buy the United States and doesn't care, can pay fines, no problem. No established advocacy group is going to engage in advertising that may trigger, through these very broad, vague, albeit unconstitutional provisions, are going to engage in advertising if they're in their right mind. Now, there are organizations that are controlled and funded by multi-billionaires, and they don't care. So they're out there doing this. They have certainly written in their budget, you know, $50 million for lawyers, fines, things like that. No, but no problem when you have billions of dollars. You know, that's 10 minutes of interest. So now, there is litigation on this subject, which has been brought by two organizations who are attacking this policy, and we will unfortunately probably wait till after the election to see whether or not all these people whose speech has been chilled, whose participation has been prohibited, that is guaranteed by the First Amendment that says Congress shall make the law, have been harmed, but who cares? The elections occur.
Well, thank you, everybody. Certainly thank you to Jim and the rest of the panel. It really is actually an honor to follow Jim at this kind of event. He and I, as he mentioned, have agreed from time to time and disagreed from time to time, but he certainly has a record of success and zealous and effective advocacy for his clients that I think any election lawyer should envy. I know I certainly do. I thought I was going to start off my remarks today with basically two topics. I'm going to talk a little bit about a part of the election law that I find actually worthwhile, that I think has been a success, that is under some pressure, actually, from current events and kind of the changes of technology. And then I'll talk about one of those changes of technology in particular that I happen to be involved in an advisory opinion request the FEC is considering now. I'm going to start off by describing the corporate prohibition. This is actually one of the subsets, I think, of the issues that Jim just outlined about the kind of the issues facing the FEC in particular, and I guess other state campaign finance regulatory agencies, which is the degree to which the law prohibits corporations, and particularly for-profit corporations, although I think sometimes, you know, to a unfortunately large extent, also nonprofit corporations. But one of the ways in which the kind of independent activity that Jim described is regulated is through this categorical corporate prohibition that any corporation, or labor union for that matter, is categorically prohibited from engaging in activities that constitute express advocacy. That has led to, I think, a couple of outcomes that, you know, it might start off from kind of an understandable premise, but the way in which it's actually being undertaken has, I think, been off track basically in two ways. One of which is that the primary way in which that was litigated was about the definition of express advocacy. The entire test became about exactly how much more proof do you need of the election purpose of what's going on, besides the so-called magic words. This Part B definition of express advocacy, which I think is sometimes described at least as being an attempt at creating kind of an if it quacks and if it likes rain, then it must be a duck kind of test. If it kind of looks and feels like it's about influencing elections, we're going to consider it to be express advocacy. I think that has justifiably and really accurately been determined to be unconstitutionally vague, which left, I think, the state of the law in a position that all you were really restricting under this corporate prohibition was the magic words express advocacy. That, in turn, teed up Title II, then, of McCain-Feingold, this idea that regardless of the content of the communication, what we want to do is go the other direction. Instead of this very vague, you know, we know it when we see it kind of rule for the content, we're going to create an extremely bright line for the content. If it references a federal office holder on TV or radio before an election, that's an election ad, you know, until proven otherwise. What Jim, I think, has very effectively done is to prove that a lot of ads in that category are genuine lobbying messages. This is actually not about influencing election, but it's about changing a policy. Maybe a vote is up before Congress about a particular bill, and to pressure that office holder, you need to be able to bring a message into that person's constituency to say, we support this bill, we want to oppose these filibusters. And the corporate prohibition, as defined in BCRA, had come to limit that kind of speech. So what we have, I think, at bottom then is a corporate prohibition, which I think you should 10 seconds on exactly why I think that is worthwhile. In short, not everybody gets to run a corporation. The entirety, my judgment, of the regulation of money in politics is about balancing freedom versus equality. That there are basically two first-order principles of what we think as liberal democracy that in this kind of context, in the context of spending money on politics, are actually in tension, that it's hard to really manage those in a way that is consistent with both. If we're going to allow people to, as much freedom as we can, well, not everybody is rich and not everybody runs corporations. On the alternative, if we run everything towards the equality zone, so we try to underpin the equality rationale while it comes at a cost of the freedom rationale. Maybe we look at expenditure limits, for example. It's worth keeping in mind that in the original Watergate, post-Watergate structure of the law, you could not spend more than $1,000 of your own money to put an ad in the paper saying defeat Birkenstock, elect Bob, whatever you wanted to say. That, again, that kind of expenditure limitation, I think, was appropriately struck down because that was too much of an imposition on freedom. But this corporate expenditure prohibition, then, I think, falls into this zone somewhere in between. How far can we go in making sure that we're not restricting freedom while we recognize that comes at the cost of equality? So the outcome that I prefer, actually, is one that I think needs to build on the way that we regulate political expenditures by non-corporate juridical persons. We have a regulation now, actually, about partnerships, for example, that are allowed to do expenditures and are allowed to even make contributions to candidates as long as they source that back, if they attribute that spending to a partner or, you know, an owner of the LLC. And in my view, at least, again, kind of in an abstract way, I think that kind of principle could be applied even to the for-profit corporate world to try to maintain what I view as being the two worthwhile pieces of this law. If it's your money, if it's your personal resources, that's where freedom has to kind of weigh out. That's where the freedom interest, I think, is at a premium. If it's not your money, however, if it's actually the shareholders' money, or maybe those shareholders don't agree. I think the Austin case is the one in which this was tested, and I've always kind of felt that the two rationales they identified in Austin didn't do an effective job in identifying what the real basis for that restriction was. They talk about protecting the public from these kind of immense aggregations of wealth, which, if taken at its face, would even uphold the $1,000 expenditure limitation that Buckley overturned. So I thought that was kind of the wrong way to put it. And the second was this idea of protecting shareholders as such. That, you know, I think that's getting at the point that I'm making, but not in exactly the right way. The PAC option is one that is used to try to address that by saying it's the shareholders do consent. If they ideologically believe that these kinds of expenses are worthwhile, well, then they can voluntarily put some money in a PAC, and that's what the corporation can use to make contributions and make expenditures. The problem that I think I know from a practice perspective has been that not everybody wants to put all that burden together of actually forming a PAC and filing reports and keeping all the, you know, the process in place to be prepared to do that. So as I viewed it, this partnership option is one that can allow a non-PAC approach that still meets the kind of standards we were looking for in that freedom versus equality balancing act that I think the law should be trying to undertake. Final point I wanted to make was about a development in technology that kind of illustrates the way in which this 1970s era law is running into circumstances now that those drafters in the 70s simply couldn't have foreseen. I've got a client called VoterVoter.com, which, as they described it, is attempting to try to merge YouTube with ActBlue, by the way. That if you, you know, you have people who create their own videos on YouTube, for example, there's some really very creative materials out there. Well, the idea behind Voter Voter was, why don't we let people create their own videos about candidates and basically create their own ads? Why don't you take a video camera, go off and shoot your own 30-second ad? You post it on VoterVoter.com with the hope that somebody else then, maybe George Soros or Richard Mellon Scaife, I mean, you know, whichever angle you're trying ideology you're trying to support, you hope that somebody else will come along and say, look, that's a great video. That's a really clever, creative product. I will use that as my personal independent expenditure. I'll spend $1 million for the airtime, but you put up the video for free. In the 70s era construct of this law, the questions that poses from a practice perspective are you now a group? I mean, Jim mentioned too, you know, with the way that you define a political committee is a group of people. Well, before the internet existed, a group was pretty easy to identify. People sitting around the table saying, hey, I'd like to shoot this clever ad. Can you go off and shoot it and I'll pay for it? That's not hard to identify as a group. In the internet context, and again, I think the YouTube analogy is the one that really bears out, those people very likely, almost certainly, will never meet. They will never talk to each other. They may not have any idea who each other is. And so the point is, technology is making possible these kinds of collaborations that when this law was drafted simply couldn't have even been conceivable. So it leads, in my view, to some square peg round hole problems that I think the next president, the next Congress, from a legislative perspective, I think would do best to make these changes through the legislative process rather than through the judicial process, which I think has been leading effectively to kind of the patchwork that we've got. One piece gets upheld, another piece gets struck down. We don't have kind of a cohesive, this is what we meant kind of whole. We just have what's left after the constitutional cases are over with. So I will leave it with that and turn it over to Rick.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you for a bit this morning. Gosh, there's so many things that I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about the idiocy of the Republican Party and the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004 that has created some of the problems that Jim talked about and caused us a major reform opportunity. I'd like to talk about various other things, but I'm going to focus instead on pick up on a couple of themes that Joe raised again, which is what I consider to be sort of the current meltdown of the campaign finance system at the present time. I think it goes without saying that McCain-Feingold has failed. I don't think there was any serious argument to be made where it is made that it has achieved any meaningful objective. People will talk about, oh yes, we no longer have office holders raising $50,000 contribution in soft money, to which the answer is, so who cares? In other words, is our country better governed? Is confidence in government higher? Is the economy doing better? If we mark that one off. I think we go down this list, there's no tangible results. In other words, it has affected how people fund campaigns. It has moved money around, but I don't think that anybody can sit and say that we have fewer scandals in Congress, less corruption. The era of McCain-Feingold is the era of William Jefferson with his cash in the fridge. It's the era of Bob Ney and the era of Duke Cunningham and so on. So I don't think there's much argument to be made there. The question is, where do we go from here? I mean, this is sort of best try, and political speech right now in this country is regulated more heavily than at any time in our nation's history, except for the brief period between the passage of McCain-Feingold and Jim's victory in Wisconsin Right to Life, in which case it was regulated just a little bit more than it is now. Okay? So we're at that kind of framework here. Now, we can try to regulate more. I mean, that's one solution that is raised, but I'm not very confident that one can do that in accordance with the First Amendment ideal that most Americans would want to have. And then we begin to see, as I say, sort of the meltdown of the system. Joe has even mentioned how things have changed since the 1970s, but the regulatory system has not. For example, the very idea of media has changed. In the 1970s, you were talking about three networks that generally viewed themselves as being unbiased professional journalists. You were talking about that sort of period, which is actually a fairly brief period in history, where the idea of journalists was to be sort of impartial and nonpartisan. That idea has fallen apart, in part because people attacked it as being something that wasn't really true. Journalists pretended to be, you know, nonpartisan, but really they weren't. They had their biases as well. However that came about, the end result of now is that, of course, there are dozens of television stations. There are, within the newspaper community, there's what's called advocacy journalism. You have major daily papers like the Philadelphia Inquirer announcing proudly on their front page that their purpose is to elect John Kerry in 2004. That's what they're after. That's their goal for the year 2004. I mean, they made that announcement publicly right up there. That's what's influencing their news coverage. That's how they want to cover things. And, of course, many people would argue that is even more so the goal of a much larger swath of the media at this point in time. But we've also seen a great expansion of the media through things like newsletters that people put out initially. As publishing costs go down, the question becomes what is, in fact, the press? And what about people who want to devote, for example, or publish books? You know, we had way back in 1964, Phyllis Schlafly's self-published book, Choice, Not an Echo, about the Goldwater campaign. It sold several million copies. But nowadays, of course, self-publishing, desktop publishing, and so on, is easier and easier. And not just the books, but also the movies and DVDs that you can get distributed fairly easily. We have more and more political movies distributed by major movie houses. You know, the classic example would be Fahrenheit 9/11, but you've also got another Oliver Stone fantasy coming out in a couple of weeks called W. You've got the movie American Carol going around now. So these kinds of things are out there, again, breaking down this notion that you can kind of cordon off a professional media away from the idea of those kind of dirty, grubby people who are actually campaigning for a candidate. The Internet, of course, is a huge issue there as well. And how do we define the Internet, and how do we separate it from other media? And can we regulate the Internet? What do we do? Now, we're not going into all the details, but basically the FEC, despite a lot of pressure from the courts to do otherwise, and pressure from the reform groups, which they now kind of deny, but it was true at the time, they really wanted the FEC to regulate the Internet heavily, and the FEC has largely resisted that. The FEC remains largely a free zone. One way in which it's free, for example, is with something like voter-voter. The Internet has an exemption that the FEC enacted as a regulatory measure, allows individuals to upload videos to the web, and that is not counted as a contribution or an independent expenditure by an individual. And that's what enables something like voter-voter to work. Or, you know, the Tower of Clients here. I'm representing a group called SesMeTV, which does essentially very similar activities to voter-voter, but works to put ads on cable television through much the same process or upload on the web. You can go there, buy them as an independent expenditure, they go on TV. And with cable, you can do this for $35, $40, $50. You can see your television ad or your ad on TV. This is a marvelous democratizing effect. But throughout this, regulation keeps pressuring these things down. The regulatory hurdles that you have to jump through, that Joe is trying to get through, that I'm trying to work around with my clients, that others are trying to, it's very difficult. Throughout this campaign, which there was a spontaneous pent-up emotion to for Ron Paul and so on, I'm getting calls all through the campaign from Ron Paul supporters, and they want to do this, and they want to do that, and they want to do the other, and all of them are unrelated to the campaign in any meaningful way. And again, you sit down and start talking about the regulation, here's what they have to go through, and the enthusiasm collapses, and they decide, well, I'll have to figure out some other way to express their enthusiasm. So this is an ongoing problem. Now, let me suggest that the end result is we need to start really rethinking what we're doing. We need to go in a different direction. I've said this, of course, for a long time because it corresponds with my basic ideological beliefs, that freedom works and that freedom is a good thing and that freedom is especially important when we want to talk about politics. But here we're simply reaching the limits that even if you don't agree with me, it becomes increasingly obvious we're simply reaching the limits of the ability of the regulatory system to do anything other than gum up the works and make it harder for ordinary citizens to participate in politics. So even if you don't like political freedom and think it would be a lot better if we regulated a lot more, you're pretty much at the end of your rope. There's not a whole lot more that you can do, and maybe the suggestion is to turn in the other direction. Now, one of the areas that has been very successful in the last couple of years is the internet deregulation. The Halliwater was supposed to be the result. Blogs dominated by evil corporations. The Halliwater was going to be at the end. Rob Blogger didn't quite have the same ring, so that may be Halliwater. That hasn't happened. The internet's a wonderful, you know, there's lots of bad speech on the internet, but nobody really thinks, well, except for the New York Times editorial board, that we can regulate speech because of the content of the speech, you know, in terms of otherwise, it may be people say dumb things on the internet, but it is definitely a democratizing item. And this has been extremely successful. Even the reform lobby basically won't touch that now. They don't want to say a word about it because they know they go out and say, oh, we need to regulate the internet more. They'll get creamed, you know, politically. It's a great success. And this shows, I think, that we should be willing to try to move in the direction of greater freedom. So that I proposed a very, very moderate reform agenda. I mean, this is remarkably moderate. Basically, it consists of continuing to keep our hands off things we already have our hands off. But we might, for example, as Joe's talking about, the corporate contribution ban. Now, many states do not have a ban on corporate contributions. In fact, I think a majority of states allow at least some form of direct corporate contribution. Some of the best governed states, like Virginia and Utah, at least with the Pew Charitable Trust regulatory governing magazines to believe, Virginia and Utah are one of the best governed states in the United Nations, have unlimited corporate contributions if you want to make them. But we don't need to go to unlimited corporate contributions if you're once uncomfortable with that. We could simply allow corporations and unions to contribute on the same basis as we allow individuals or now PACs to contribute with some type of limit on how much they can spend. And this would actually be democratizing. It would help small corporations contribute directly as a corporation rather than have to set up a PAC where they're at a big disadvantage to a large corporation because they can't afford the administrative costs and they don't have as many people that they can solicit for contributions. We should remove the restriction on party coordination. The parties should be able to coordinate activities with their candidates. That's what parties are for. Parties can only raise hard money nowadays, so there's no question of big soft money sneaking in. We should raise all of the thresholds in the Act to account for inflation. McCain Feingold raised some of the thresholds. It didn't raise them nearly enough. We would raise them all for inflation. The individual contribution limit would about double, including aggregate limits on how much you could give. PAC contribution limits would more or less quadruple. Disclosure regulations, the point at which you have to disclose everything, would go up by 3 to 4 times since any of these were last adjusted for inflation. Those are just a few ideas of a very moderate agenda that we might hope that Congress will take up in the future. Thank you.
Well, good morning, one and all. Nice to be with you. I do enjoy that being on this panel. I have enjoyed being in the company of these gentlemen for many years. Having just used the word enjoy, I noted in the introduction you said that I enjoyed a long service at the Federal Election Commission. I'm not sure that I would characterize it as enjoyable the entire time. Yes, pretty rousing battles and incredible under Carl Bonnelly. I did want to note once again the irony. You probably have heard this joke in many other speeches, but I was waiting for the moment when you were going to say, "Into the right of Brad Smith." Yeah, it was delicious. Brad and I, we had many disagreements, but I have to say he was always of good humor, and I always enjoyed working with him. What can I say about Jim? Bob, Jim had basically, I jokingly referred to my clients as Jim being basically the author of current campaign finance law, and in a real sense, he is. His litigation over the years has really shaped where we are today. I wanted to sort of give you a little case study of his current litigation. He has taken on the existing regulations and so on in a case that's called The Real Truth About Obama versus the Federal Election Commission. And it's litigation he started in Virginia. I think you're now in the Fourth Circuit battling out where your efforts to get a preliminary injunction and joining those regulations will turn out. But I look wistfully at what's going on. You know, Jim has referred to the express advocacy standard. Well, really, what the Supreme Court seems to have distilled from all of this back and forth about what express advocacy is comes sort of back down to a reasonable person test. Would a reasonable person think that this communication is advocating a candidate's election or defeat? And we at the Federal Election Commission back in the mid-90s battled about the exact same standard, and we put it into a regulation back in that time frame, and we had a hell of a fight. On the day that we finally approved that, Commissioner Akins, Joan Akins, was pushing very hard to have Trevor Potter vote against the staff proposed language. It contained the phrasing, encourage someone's election or defeat, and she did not want any regulation that used just the word encourage. She thought it should go further and say exhort. Well, Jared Potter was caught in the middle. He was going to be the fourth vote for this regulation, if anybody. And Commissioner McDonald was beating him from the other side, and he was raising his voice quite loudly, and he said, for God's sake, can you show a little courage for once? And so that's how we ended up with the regulation. It's on the books, which basically reflects the existing Supreme Court standard on what is express advocacy. But all of this is a way of coming around to where Jim Bopp has gotten the courts to be. He has, and I think he wants to take the court further. I think if he's not comfortable with the Supreme Court's reasonable person analysis and would like to go back more towards, say, the magic words test. But in any event, that's kind of a little interesting history from my perspective. That is where we are. Also somewhat interesting to me is now the Federal Election Commission, having traditionally fought against the views of, say, Justice Thomas, who, as you know, would put aside all of these restrictions on corporate and union spending. The FEC is using Justice Thomas's analysis in the Wisconsin Right to Life case to say that Justice Thomas has clarified that all of those lower court decisions using the magic words test have been thrown over by the Supreme Court's decision in Wisconsin Right to Life. It's an interesting thing to see the Federal Election Commission relying on Justice Thomas's analysis to support their position in defending the current regulations. But things are always amusing. I find it much easier now that I'm out of the Federal Election Commission to observe this with wry humor. It used to be I had to basically defend the existing law. That was my job, I felt, as a commissioner. Now, in that litigation, though, I think you can sort of get a sense of where this battle is joined in a real-world sense. One of the ads that the Real Truth About Obama folks is putting forward, something they say they want to run, reads as follows. You've got a woman's voice that says, just what is the real truth about Democrat Barack Obama's position on abortion? And then an Obama-like voice chimes in. Change. Here's how I would like to change America about abortion. One, make taxpayers pay for all 1.2 million abortions performed in America each year. Two, make sure that minor girls' abortions are kept secret from their parents. Three, make partial birth abortion legal. Four, give Planned Parenthood lots more money to support abortion. Five, change current federal and state laws so that babies who survive abortions will die soon after they are born. Six, appoint more liberal justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. One thing I would not change about America is abortion on demand. For any reason, at any time during pregnancy, as many times as a woman wants one. The woman's voice comes back. Now you know the real truth about Obama's position on abortion. Is this the change you can believe in? So here's the question. Is that express advocacy or not under the reasonable person test? That Federal Election Commission in the litigation conceded, in essence, we would never treat that as express advocacy, coming from their perspective. The district court judge, however, said, what? Of course that's express advocacy, no doubt about it. So, now Jim's got that up on appeal. But that's a real-life example of where this battle is right now. and how you find it exceedingly difficult to make sense out of what the standard really is. So I would say, I agree with everything that's been said. The current state of the law is a mess. I spend my time now trying to explain to clients whether they can put out a communication. I have to go over the existing express advocacy test with the reasonable person spin. I have to go over the electioneering communication test with the reasonable person spin. I have to go over the coordinated communication regulations the FEC has promulgated. Horribly complicated. A content test, a conduct test, each with multiple subparts. It gets a little bit dicey, including this two people. Also, I have to explain the internet regulations. The FEC has created some interesting exceptions for a lot of internet-related activity, but it's pretty hard to explain to people how those rules work in the coordinated communication context when you're dealing with, say, a business corporation or a union trying to put out a communication, say, on their own website, or maybe using email, where they've got a nice email list they want to send something out in that form. Do the commission's internet exceptions apply there or not? It's pretty unclear, I have to say. So, the rules are a bit of a mess. So, what does that mean? Well, that said, I find myself in many discussions with very good campaign finance lawyers, or just heads of organizations who are themselves very savvy, and you know, we lawyers try to simplify things as best we can. We explain basically, okay, steer clear of the following kinds of phrases. Stay away from express advocacy or election communication. Don't talk to campaign operatives about what you're going to be doing. That avoids the coordinated communication rules. And for internet communications, you can do an awful lot of stuff. Basically, don't use your corporate resources to buy advertising on some internet website, but you can do an awful lot of other things. And it's somewhat painful for them, but ultimately they grumble, and I have to say in virtually every case I've been involved with, we find a way for them to craft the message which they can get out and they can get their message across. Sometimes you have to put it into a C3, sometimes into a C4, sometimes into a 527 that's not regulated as a political committee, sometimes into a regulated political committee. But I have to say my experience is most of the time, the speech gets out, the message gets out. So I don't know where that leaves me. I guess my conclusion here is it is complicated. It's more complicated, certainly, than I would like it to be. It's tough for clients to understand the nuances. But for the most part, the speech is getting out where people want to have the speech get out. So I'll leave it with that proposition and we can bat that around. Thank you.
Well, to now is I'll ask a couple questions now that I open up to the audience. One of the questions I wanted to talk about is we talked about where the state of the law is now, and I think the panel agrees that it leaves something to be desired. I guess I wondered, oftentimes we'll see headlines around election time about people filing complaints with the FEC with regard to advertisements either made by the candidates or made by independent groups. And a lot of times these complaints are filed either by the candidate or its supporters. And I guess I wanted to ask, especially the two former commissioners, enforcement, has the FEC basically added another tool for the campaigns or their supporters to use in getting elected? Or do we have a system where really the FEC is simply trying to enforce the rules it has? In other words, is the FEC being used as a campaign tool, or is it really simply trying to enforce the laws it sees?
Scott's not grabbing the mic, so I'll go ahead. That's the classic board question to which the answer is yes. The FEC is trying to enforce the laws it sees it, and the FEC is a tool that campaigns can use to try to harass their political opponents, which is not something that the FEC should necessarily be blamed for. They're just doing what the statute says. One of the problems with the campaign finance laws is that it's very, very easy to file a complaint and get some headlines, and it forces your opponent to begin spending legal fees. And the way our system is set up, if you file a complaint with the FEC does all the investigating and so on, so your job is to write up a complaint. That can be a page and a half long letter attached to some news clippings about the nefarious deeds of your opponent, and that's all you're in for. Your opponent is known for thousands of dollars in legal bills. At the same time, you can have a press conference in which you can talk about very serious charges have been leveled against my opponent by you, and you can talk about how the FEC is investigating it, which they are, because they have a statutory requirement that they do that if the charges are leveled. And so it's a weapon, and we need to recognize that one of the prices of these kinds of laws is that it is a weapon. Now, why do people file complaints? I suggest that very rarely do they file complaints because they're truly upset about the violations of the campaign finance law. They file the complaints because they want to stop other people from talking. That's one reason why you virtually never see people file complaints against their political opponents, or I mean against their political allies. They only file them against their political opponents, and only when their opponents seem to be doing something that harms them. That is getting a message out that's very difficult. The New York Times had an editorial recently about, I think it's about Jim's group that he mentioned here, in which they talked about how this group is spreading lies and the FEC had to be on guard for that and stop this, which of course is not all the FEC's job to worry about content, but it indicates that desire to simply silence speech that you don't want under the guise of dealing with campaign finance law. So it's there.
I agree. A lot of complaints get filed when they're basically nonsense. I would be intrigued with someone putting forward an idea that maybe we should go with something like an English system. If you file a complaint and it's proven not to be false, you are obligated for at least some of the attorney's fees of the respondent who was unfairly accused and whom the matter turned out to be untrue.
I think this properly falls actually in the next panel, which is election by litigation. Here in this case, it would be election by threatened litigation. And, of course, it's exacerbated by what everyone acknowledges to be these vague and indistinct laws. In other words, you just don't know at the end of the investigation whether or not you're going to be whacked. Now, of course, you do know that you will be investigated, which incurs a tremendous cost. Case I handled for the Christian Coalition, which we won in 1999. We won after a 6-year investigation and 81 depositions. Well, the fact that you won it became a little, who cares, after you're paying the cost of just simply having been investigated and a subsequent enforcement action. Now, you can see this dynamic of this is all about partisan politics. Again, by Bob Barrow, one of my favorite Democrats, I wasn't able to say what he's done this year. This year, when he was in a hot fight for representing Obama against Clinton for the nomination, of course, he sent out these extremely threatening announcements and letters to all possible Clinton-supporting 527s about how they're all going to go to jail if they say anything about the presidential race. Well, then when his candidate got into a little bit of trouble early in September, they announced that, oh, well, 527s that support Obama are just peachy, and had a conference call to tell everyone that you know, it's okay now to engage in 527 activity. The final point about this whole dynamic, besides the concern about the cost of investigation and the question about what happens at the end, is the entry cost. What Scott Thomas explained was the entry cost. These rules are so vague, so hard, so complex, so hard to understand, and you cannot come to a definitive answer unless you hire a high-priced Washington, D.C. expert in the subject. That's the entry cost. How many people in America either know where they are or who they are and can afford the hourly rate? And so this is the entry cost. You're uncertain. The only way to try to resolve the uncertainty is to hire one of these high-priced lawyers in Washington. And, of course, very few have the resources and the wherewithal and the sophistication to do that. So they shut up. That's what they do. So we have created this enormously high entry cost for participation. And I agree with what Scott says. And that is, ultimately, an expert can figure out, almost invariably, some way to get this done. But that requires hiring the expert and have an organization with the sophistication, the complex structure, and the resources to manage all of that. And that means that George Soros, America's playground for George Soros. But the average person in America is shut out. That's what it means.
I'll add just two real quick points of fact that some would note, is that there are no pleading standards and no standing requirements at the FEC. So anybody can file a complaint, and it doesn't really have to have any real basis in evidence. And I think those are problems, and I wish the FEC could muster the will to try to correct them. At least the pleading standards issue.
I guess actually what Brad brings up actually brings up another good question, and that is that the FEC resolved some of the 527 issues through enforcement actions that they had taken after the 2004 election that resolved in conciliative agreements. I guess I wonder what the panel thinks about the fact that it seems that, one, enforcement actions rather than rulemakings, and also the fact that it was conciliation agreements rather than litigation, resulted in what system we're operating now under for independent groups in their speech.
This is the definition of Tim Tyranny. To have ex post facto laws being cobbled together that you then are held into account after the fact, that is tyranny. The whole point of due process is to know ahead of time what standards you're going to be held to. There was honestly no lawyer and these rich Washington lawyers. There were none of them in the United States that believed in 2004 that the FEC was going to enforce 100.22b in terms of the definition of express evidence. No one believed that. And so they felt confident that as long as they didn't pull the trigger of a $1,000 expenditure or a $1,000 contribution, that they're safe. If we find out 2 years later that the FEC has now decided to enforce these, even in the Fourth Circuit, where it has been struck down by the Fourth Circuit. And so this is tyranny. Not to know in advance what standards you're going to be held in account to, and to be then punished by the government for a standard that you had no notice of.
So I
like Shave's idea. We should have a rule, which he tried to get them to do, and they preferred the tyranny to ruling.
I mean, the piece about the absence of a rule on major purpose in particular, I couldn't agree more with. I think that is, and it is a fundamental part of the standard for what constitutes a PAC, which the FEC, I think, has taken a couple of, the OGC, the Office of General Counsel, has kind of drafted up a couple of options, but the Commission itself has certainly never articulated any rule that defines what that is, overtly preferring instead a kind of, facts and circumstances. We must have flexibility to evaluate this where we find it. I'm not in favor of that, but I did want to, at least from my perspective, explain that the 527 conciliation agreements that grew out of the 2004 cycle were not only Part B express advocacy cases. Had it only been Part B express advocacy at issue, I also believe those would not have actually been taken as far as they were. The crux that I found in those matters was the application of 100.57, the solicitation regulation Jim mentioned earlier. That, the way in which the Commission arrived at that, I think, has been a little bit of a convoluted story, that this kind of sprung fully formed from a disclaimer case at the end of the 90s, I did not actually find very convincing. Having said that, though, it really was enacted through a rulemaking process in the early-ish part of the cycle in 2004. So at least with respect to the solicitation reg, I personally don't think the idea that that was a kind of a sandbagging effort really is convincing. But I definitely want to agree with the idea that these laws are at their most defensible when they are announced ahead of time and you have an opportunity to reflect, to change your strategies in regard to the rules. The takeaway on that, one of the things about VoterVoter.com, right, that you kind of make another plug for my client here, is that if you look nationwide, at state level, personal independent expenditures are actually not that uncommon. In a lot of state, particularly local races, individual independent expenditures are a fairly significant part of the political scene. I think at the federal level, it seems to me, they've been almost non-existent. And I think maybe part of that can be if there's a technological solution to solve the problem that Jim identified of needing to hire an election lawyer to explain how to handle your activities. If all you need to do is a personal independent expenditure, I don't think you're going to need a lawyer. It's actually a two-page form. You just disclose what you spent, and you're done with it. But that has not been a real active means of the process so far.
I have
I don't know how to. I'm going to try to be brief, and I'm not sure if I can, but I think that as a CLE, this kind of needs to go into the main purpose. But also, again, I'm going to talk about where's that pop out. The major purpose test is, in my view, not a test that can ever be used to create somebody, to make somebody into a political committee, which would not otherwise be a political committee. In other words, if their acts and deeds do not fall within certain restrictions of the law, it doesn't matter what their purpose is. Okay? If my purpose is to elect John McCain president, and I think I can do that by drinking a lot of water, it will not be a violation of the Federal National Campaign Act. No matter how much water I drink, and no matter how strongly I believe, that's how you get John McCain elected president. And we could take that into more serious things to accomplish. You have to engage in certain activities. Now, the major purpose test comes out of a couple of court cases in which the court basically simply says, well, in Buckley they say, if the group has this as major purpose, elected officials then might be required to disclose, whereas otherwise it's not required to disclose to donors. They don't talk anything what they mean about that. I think if you read the case, what they meant by that was, if you're the McCain for President Committee or the Republican National Committee, you're covered, and otherwise you're not. But they don't talk about that. And then in Massachusetts Citizens for Life, it's a case that comes up where they say that even a nonprofit corporation, despite the corporation ban, can make some express advocacy expenditures if and not be limited by that, because the First Amendment protection is for a nonprofit volunteer group, right? As long as electing people doesn't become their major purpose. Okay? In other words, a group that would otherwise be prohibited can in fact do this, a less major purpose is the purpose. Nowhere has the court ever suggested that major purpose can be an offensive thrust to wrap people into the regulatory system who are otherwise not in the regulatory system. And that is why the FEC did not pass a rule on major purpose, because most of the commissioners, bipartisan majority, didn't think that you could do that at the time. Now, then we get to the question of that Joe raised of the Survival Education Fund. This is Regulation 100.57. One of the Republican commissioners, under a great deal of pressure, said, you know, we need to do something here because the Bush people are just trying to beat the hell out of me, essentially, that we're not stopping these Democrats from attacking us. It was in the middle of 2004, and the Republicans were like, oh, there's not 527, you know, because it's going to work out for our benefit, but not a simple benefit. There's the truth or something. So I guess they hadn't thought about it. So they said, okay, so we're going to stop this. And we noted that it does seem that when a group specifically says we want to regulate or we want money from you in order to defeat this candidate, to me that is express advocacy. In other words, if a group sends out a mailing saying, you need to send our 527 money, and the reason you need to send us money is because we're going to use it to beat George Bush, right? Well, I think that's in and of itself a public communication expressly advocating the defeat of a candidate and should be regulated on that basis, which the FEC had not really been doing. If it was a fundraising letter, that was in itself considered a public communication. One of my colleagues felt very, very strongly, and to hold together a coalition, I eventually felt, okay, we can do it this way. We put it in that if you solicit funds expressly advocating the defeat of a candidate, then that will make you a political committee as well. It's a contribution for the purpose of defeating someone. At that time, at least in my mind, and I don't know if it was in other commissioners' book, but my mind was, again, that letter. You send out something with the four corners of your document saying, give us money to defeat somebody. It doesn't matter how you spent it. The letter itself would convert you into a committee if you had donations in that. But the FEC has used that in ways that I, you know, never dreamed of. It's the worst decision I ever made on the FEC. Which is to effectively go out to donors and ask them individually, what was represented to you in your private conversations? Or even more, why did you make that contribution? To which the donor says, well, I wanted to, you know, beat Barack Obama. And it's a contribution. Now, the committee might have been scrupulously careful, and you can imagine the conversation with the donor. He goes to the donor, they say, you know, we've really got to get word out there about this Irish connection on Barack Obama, you know. And the donor says, I'm just so hypothetical, by the way, do you want to emphasize that, right? So the donor says, yeah, I think that'd be really important. We can't have a guy like this as president. He says, now, you're going to, you know, so what are you going to say in these ads? Well, we're not going to say defeat Obama.
You're not. But this will help defeat Obama. Well, it might. But we're not saying that that's what we're going to say. Okay, I'll give it $100,000. Right. Now the FTC comes back and says, why would you give that money? He says, well, to defeat Obama. Right? What did they tell you it was going to do? They told you it was going to defeat Obama. Well, they didn't tell him that, but he's not keeping a recording of the conversation for the investigation that comes along 17 months later. He's hearing what he wants to hear. And so the FTC, I mean, we passed a regulation that was, I think it's solid, the idea that if you send out a fundraising letter to 10,000 people saying, you know, this guy's terrible, he ought to be defeated, but that isn't itself a public communication. We put it in the wrong section of the law due to no fault of my own other than unwillingness or inability to persuade my colleagues that they were mistaken and a soft spine that led me to go on with them. And then enforcement of this by the General Counsel's Office, supported by the Commissioner to Remain after I resigned, right, that's not real, who have used it in ways that at least I never would have imagined that you use it, which I agree are totally unconstitutional. But that's a long, I'm sorry, but I do want to point out that I don't think you want a major purpose rule, unless that major purpose rule is to say the only committees that have a major purpose are candidate committees and party committees, and otherwise you don't, unless you're a PAC. I don't see where the notice of major purpose was a problem because major purpose is not a benefit or a basis for regulations.
I think the key to support the FTC coming to a definition of major purpose, as long as it's the right one, of course. And I think the right one is explained, and I know this is a CLE event, which, and I should have told Dean that this case took your materials. North Carolina Right to Life versus the decision by the Fourth Circuit, written by Judge Wilkinson like last May, just 5 months ago. It is the best post-Wisconsin Right to Life campaign finance decision, in my view, explaining the current state of the law. And what he says in the major purpose discussion is that the only activities that you can count toward a major purpose is regulable activity, regulable, and that is express advocacy communications, contributions to candidates. It's not something broader than that. You know, some vague standards that the FTC is proudly using right now, and that has been published in their PAC status 1 and PAC status 2 notices in the Federal Register. And that is to include anything that might influence an election, regardless of whether or not it's actually regulable under the FECA. So, if you got it down to that, I think you would have the right test.
Can I just jump in real quickly? I find this discussion tantalizing, as of course I was there when we had a big fight on whether to implement a regulation that would actually try to define major purpose, and I was very much in favor of that. And I had one commissioner on the Republican side who was willing to go along with that, but we were out over 4-2. So I'm sort of between Jim and Brad on this. I do regret that there are investigations going on where questions from the FEC are in the nature of what did you say to that person soliciting the money? I don't think that the FEC has any business asking that kind of question. But I gather, given the way the regulation is crafted, they do have now the obligation to say, what did the person soliciting the money from you say? And that's basically what it comes down to. Did that person say something like, this money will be used to support or oppose the election of a candidate? That's the reality of where we are with that test. And I think that, I don't know if there's a better way to express it. I think Brad's intuition about is how do you define whether something is a contribution or not? I think his intuition about that kind of a regulation is probably accurate.
I don't want to let the panel go without taking any questions from the audience. Mr. Stokowski,
before I ask a question, I just want to say, there was another vote in 2006 on whether to come up with a regulation defining major purpose. And once again, this question is just Chairman Thomas. It relates back to the whole problem that causes all the complexities. Joe has talked about, that's the ban on corporate contributions.
And the premise of my question is that that ban was passed in 1907. It was signed by Teddy Roosevelt, and it was put in place because there were huge corporate contributions to the 1904 campaign, including, I think, $500,000 by New York Life Insurance. Extraordinary amount of money. But we've now had a limit. Contributions were unlimited then. We have limits on contributions. What is the public policy rationale, do you think, for continuing this corporate ban, since a corporation will only be able to contribute $2,300 over each election, just like an individual?
I have to say, I've always been willing to go with the idea of putting a limit on corporate contributions rather than trying to prohibit them. It strikes me that that's a very reasonable regulation format. In terms of do we need them, is it good government policy? I always had a sense, just based on my perception of what I read, what I was aware of, having come to Washington the very summer of President Nixon's departure and all about the Watergate scandal, as they called it. My perception is that we have some office holders who will go out of their way to provide a favor for someone who, in fact, has provided campaign support. That is a reality of the human condition. So I have always felt that, bottom line, if you put a reasonable system of regulation in place, it is justifiable. If you can prevent some corporate entity or union entity that has massive amounts of resources from giving an unlimited amount of money to help a candidate get elected, you're probably better off because you're going to at least restrain the situation where that candidate is going to feel basically a strong compulsion to try to do whatever that supporter wants to. I still believe that concept, that basic party organization said. So I guess I wouldn't care if you went with a set of contribution limits as opposed to a ban. I think that would work fine.
I just want to observe very quickly, the model of treating corporate contributions as individual contributions has an appeal from a simplicity perspective. But there is kind of a nested lurking issue in there about the proliferation of corporations. Parent subsidiary relationships, for example, open this question of whether you treat all of the family of corporations as one corporation, or can you kind of string out separate corporations? And I always talk about the example of a franchisor, for example, who owns 50 Subways. If each of those are separate corporations, and they can each give a separate $2,300, you've got one guy in a position to give well north of $100,000 directly to a candidate. So it's the nature of a juridical person, a donor who's not a human being, kind of creates all these questions of how far can you go to make yourself more attractive to that candidate by just being able to provide money that people who don't happen to own a chain of corporations can't provide.
If you want to take the moderate step of simply raising a lot of corporate contributions and limiting them, Joe's raised an issue with that, but of course you can deal with that. And many states, in fact, have that corporate contribution that are allowed but limited, and I don't know that the proliferation has been too big a problem. Just a quick point. Joe mentioned earlier, too, the phrase in his opening comments about the immense aggregations of wealth, which the Supreme Court cites all the time, the need to prevent immense aggregations of wealth. That comes from Elihu Root in the late 19th, early 20th century statesman, who some of you may be familiar with. And when he said that, he then went on and talked about the amounts of money he had in mind. And in inflation-adjusted dollars, that would be a minimum of $1 million today. So he wasn't really, he was talking about a lot more money than people give. Even in the heyday of soft money, the firm became fine with there were fewer than 20 corporations who ever gave $1 million contributions in an election cycle, in any one election cycle. And Root was also talking about, he listed the great insurance companies, the railroad trust, the bank, something like that. And of course, remember 100 years ago, you didn't have every nickel and dime nonprofit, every corner, gas station, every person providing personal services and so on, be incorporated. So the nature of the corporation has changed dramatically, and I do think that the public policy rationale has changed and really needs to be reconsidered.
I have two contributions to this discussion. First is, I have trouble with this concept of Brad Smith as a moderate. Much of the problem goes back to the contribution limit. Contribution limits are so low that people, it's a supply and demand problem. You have an interest at stake that is worth X amount of money to spend to protect that interest. You can only give $2,300 to a candidate. But defense of this interest means you're prepared to spend, let's say, $50,000. Well, then what do? You've got to figure out some way to spend the $47,000 to influence the process, and in this case, the election. So you have to, you know, go out and try to figure out how to do that. So it's a very simple problem. And if people could give more money to candidates, then they would have less incentive to participate independently. And if you go to states where this supply and demand problem is properly dealt with, like Indiana, where there are no contribution limits at all from individuals, you do have a couple of independent spenders, the chamber, the manufacturers, and the union, several unions. But beyond that, you know, there's only a couple of interest groups, and you don't have this huge proliferation that you have in the federal system. And of course, the justification is to prevent corruption, which is the undue influence of the contribution. Well, you know, we actually have some empirical evidence of how much money that is. I mean, how much money was in Congressman Jefferson's freezer? $99,000, considerably more than $2,300. Duke Cunningham, remember, he had a list. You know, it would cost you X amount of money to him to get certain things, okay, out of his committee in terms of earmarks for various projects. I don't remember any of those being in five figures in terms of his list, laundry list of bribes that he would take. So it's just, we are just incredibly low in terms of the contribution limit, which then necessarily spawns all of this activity that is now less desirable, constitutionally protected, but less desirable in terms of accountability and democracy. If you're giving money to the candidate, he's spending it, man, you can go right on the ballot and deal with him if you don't like what he's doing. Okay? Well, if it's the political party that's spending the money, actually, that's the next most accountable vehicle, because you go on the ballot and you see the Republican Party and Democrat Party. If you don't like what they're doing, then you can punish their candidates for it. But at that point, when we're outside of those actors, the accountability is much more difficult for the voter and for our democratic process. So McCain-Feingold and Federal Election Campaign Act, both two most dramatic effects, which is low contribution limits, from the Watergate amendments, and secondly, kneecapping political parties through soft money prohibitions, has now pushed that money away from candidates, away from political parties, through the most accountable vehicle, and now into the least accountable types. And as we roll out the regulations that the reformers want, okay, let's now stop 527. Well, remember, 527s now report all of their activity to the IRS, and that's public. All their contributions, all their expenditures. What else is going to go into it? We have seen already LLCs, for-profit LLCs, no reporting, no nothing, no anything. Well, they're pumping their head up around, okay? They're the most likely vehicle of choice for this independent activity. If it's stopped in 527, which the IRS is targeted, the FEC is targeted by their enforcement policy. So it's just, it's worse. It gets worse every time. Another layer of regulation, the accountability decreases, the transparency decreases, and the freedom decreases.
Frank, I'm going to have to act like the red light here. That's the end of our time, so we can get you all fed, but please thank our panel.